You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
This is an announcement to all United States vehicle owners who own a 2003 or newer vehicle with a manufacturer's warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all. With a struggling economy and the cost of living on the rise, Endurance is now offering an affordable, low-cost vehicle coverage plan to the general public. As of today, you could be one of millions of drivers that now may qualify to have your vehicle protected under this coverage and have all future covered auto repairs paid directly to the repair shop for you. You pick your plan, you pick your deductible, you even pick the repair shop. Roadside service, towing, and rental coverage is included. To all United States vehicle owners who own a 2003 or newer vehicle with a manufacturer's warranty about to expire, get your vehicle protected now and save your wallet from costly vehicle repairs. For your free 5-minute quote and to see if you qualify, visit EnduranceWarranty.com. EnduranceWarranty.com.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Checkris, London, UK. The Triumphs of Eugene Valmont by Robert Barr. Chapter 7. The Liberation of Wyoming Ed. A man should present the whole truth to his doctor, his lawyer, or his detective. If a doctor is to cure, he must be given the full confidence of the patient. If a lawyer is to win a case, he needs to know what tells against his client, as well as the points in his favour. If a secret agent is to solve a mystery, all the cards should be put on the table. Those who half trust a professional man need not be disappointed when results prove unsatisfactory. A partial confidence reposed in me led to the liberation of a dangerous criminal, caused me to associate with a robber, much against my own inclination, and brought me within danger of the law. Of course, I never pretend to possess that absolute confidence in the law which seems to be the birthright of every Englishman. I have lived too intimately among the machinery of the law, and have seen too many of its ghastly mistakes, to hold it in that blind esteem which appears to be prevalent in the British Isles. There is a doggerel couplet which typifies this spirit better than anything I can write, and it runs, "No rogue e'er felt the halter draw with the good opinion of the law." Those lines exemplify the trend of British thought in this direction. If you question a verdict of their courts, you are a rogue, and that ends the matter. And yet, when an Englishman undertakes to circumvent the law, there is no other man on earth who will go to greater lengths. An amazing people, never understandable by the sane of other countries. It was entirely my own fault that I became involved in affairs which were almost indefensible and wholly illegal. My client first tried to bribe me into compliance with his wishes, which bribe I sternly refused. Then he partially broke down and, quite unconsciously as I take it, made an appeal to the heart, a strange thing for an Englishman to do. My kind heart has ever been my most vulnerable point. We French are sentimentalists. France has before now staked its very existence for an ideal, while other countries fight for continents, cash, or commerce. You cannot pierce me with a lance of gold, but wave a wand of sympathy, and I am yours. There waited for me in my flat a man who gave his name as Douglas Sanderson, which may or may not have been his legitimate title. This was a question into which I never probed, and at the moment of writing am as ignorant of his true cognomen, if that was not it, as on the morning he first met me. He was an elderly man of natural dignity and sobriety, slow in speech, almost sombre in dress. His costume was not quite that of a professional man, and not quite that of a gentleman. I at once recognised the order to which he belonged, and a most difficult class it is to deal with. He was the confidential servant or steward of some ancient and probably noble family, embodying in himself all the faults and virtues, each a trifle accentuated, of the line he served, and to which, in order to produce him and his like, his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather had doubtless been attached. It is frequently the case that the honour of the house he serves is more dear to him than it is to the representative of that house. Such a man is almost always the repository of family secrets, a repository whose inviolability gold cannot affect, threats sway, or cajolery influence. I knew when I looked at him that practically I was looking at his master, for I have known many cases where even the personal appearance of the two was almost identical, which may have given rise to the English phrase, like master, like man. The servant was a little more haughty, a little less kind, a little more exclusive, a little less confidential, a little more condescending, a little less human, a little more Tory, and altogether a little less pleasant and easy person to deal with. "Sir," he began, when I had waved him to a seat, "I am a very rich man, and can afford to pay well for the commission I request you to undertake. To ask you to name your own terms may seem unbusinesslike, so I may say at the outset I am not a businessman. The service I shall ask will involve the utmost secrecy, and for that I am willing to pay. It may expose you to risk of limb or liberty, and for that I am willing to pay. It will probably necessitate the expenditure of a large sum of money. That sum is at your disposal." Here he paused. He had spoken slowly and impressively, with a touch of arrogance in his tone which aroused to his prejudice the combativeness latent in my nature. However, at this juncture I merely bowed my head and replied in accents almost as supercilious as his own, "The task must either be unworthy or unwelcome. In mentioning first the compensation, you are inverting the natural order of things. You should state at the outset what you expect me to do. Then, if I accept the commission, it is time to discuss the details of expenditure." Either he had not looked for such a reply, or was loath to open his budget, for he remained a few moments with eyes bent upon the floor and lips compressed in silence. At last he went on, without change of inflection, without any diminution of that air of condescension which had so exasperated me in the beginning, and which was preparing a downfall for himself that would rudely shake the cold dignity which encompassed him like a cloak. "It is difficult for a father to confide in a complete stranger the vagaries of a beloved son, and before doing so you must pledge your word that my communication will be regarded as strictly confidential."
"Cela va sans dire."
"I do not understand French," said Mr. Sanderson severely, as if the use of the phrase were an insult to him. I replied nonchalantly, "It means, as a matter of course, that goes without saying. Whatever you care to tell me about your son will be mentioned to no one. Pray proceed without further circumlocution, for my time is valuable." "My son was always a little wild and impatient of control. Although everything he could wish was at his disposal here at home, he chose to visit America, where he fell into bad company. I assure you there is no real harm in the boy, but he became implicated with others and has suffered severely for his recklessness. For 5 years he has been an inmate of a prison in the West. He was known and convicted under the name of Wyoming Ed. What was his crime? His alleged crime was the stopping and robbing of a railway train. For how long was he sentenced? He was sentenced for life. What do you wish me to do? Every appeal has been made to the governor of the state in an endeavour to obtain a pardon. These appeals have failed. I am informed that if money enough is expended, it may be possible to arrange my son's escape.
In other words, you wish me to bribe the officials of the jail?
I assure you the lad is innocent. For the first time a quiver of human emotion came into the old man's voice.
Then, if you can prove that, why not apply for a new trial?
Unfortunately, the circumstances of the case, of his arrest on the train itself, the number of witnesses against him, give me no hope that a new trial would end in a different verdict, even if a new trial could be obtained, which I am informed is not possible. Every legal means tending to his liberation has already been tried.
I see. And now you are determined to adopt illegal means.
I refuse to have anything to do with the malpractice you propose. You objected to a phrase in French, Mr. Sanderson. Perhaps one in Latin will please you better. It is veritas prevalebit, which means truth will prevail.
I shall set your mind entirely at rest regarding your son. Your son at this moment occupies a humble, if honourable, position in the great house from which you came, and he hopes in time worthily to fill his father's shoes, as you have filled the shoes of your father. You are not a rich man, but a servant. Your son never was in America, and never will go there. It is your master's son, the heir to great English estates, who became the Wyoming Ed of the Western Prison. Even from what you say, I do not in the least doubt he was justly convicted, and you may go back to your master and tell him so. You came here to conceal the shameful secret of a wealthy and noble house. You may return knowing that secret has been revealed, and that the circumstances in which you so solemnly bound me to secrecy never existed. Sir, that is the penalty of lying.
The old man's contempt for me had been something to be felt, so palpable was it. The armour of icy reserve had been so complete that actually I had expected to see him rise with undiminished hauteur and leave the room, disdaining further parley with one who had insulted him. Doubtless that is the way in which his master would have acted. But even in the underling I was unprepared for the instantaneous crumbling of this monument of pomp and pride. A few moments after I began to speak in terms as severe as his own, his trembling hands grasped the arms of the chair in which he sat, and his ever-widening eyes, which came to regard me with something like superstitious dread as I went on, showed me I had launched my random arrow straight at the bull's eye of fact. His face grew mottled and green rather than pale. When at last I accused him of lying, he arose slowly, shaking like a man with a palsy, but, unable to support himself erect, sank helplessly back into his chair again. His head fell forward to the table before him, and he sobbed aloud.
"God help me," he cried. "It is not my own secret I am trying to guard."
I sprang to the door, and turned the key in the lock, so that by no chance might we be interrupted. Then, going to the sideboard, I poured him out a liqueur glass full of the finest cognac ever imported from south of the Loire, and tapping him on the shoulder said brusquely, "Here, drink this. The case is no worse than it was half an hour ago. I shall not betray the secret." He tossed off the brandy and with some effort regained his self-control. "I have done my errand badly," he wailed. "I don't know what I have said that has led you to so accurate a statement of the real situation, but I have been a blundering fool. God forgive me, when so much depended on my making no mistake."
"Don't let that trouble you," I replied. "Nothing you said gave me the slightest clue."
"You called me a liar," he continued, "and that is a hard word from one man to another. But I would not lie for myself. And when I do it for one I revere and respect, my only regret is that I have done it without avail."
"My dear sir," I assured him, "the fault is not with yourself at all. You were simply attempting the impossible. Stripped and bare, your proposal amounts to this. I am to betake myself to the United States, and there commit a crime, or a series of crimes, in bribing sworn officials to turn traitor to their duty and permit a convict to escape."
"You put it very harshly, sir. You must admit that, especially in new countries, there is lawlessness within the law as well as outside of it.
The real criminals in the robbery of the railway train escaped. My young master, poor fellow, was caught. His father, one of the proudest men in England, has grown prematurely old under the burden of this terrible dishonour. He is broken-hearted and a dying man, yet he presents an impassive front to the world with all the ancient courage of his race. My young master is an only son, and failing his appearance, should his father die, title and estate will pass to strangers. Our helplessness in this situation adds to its horror. We dare not make any public move. My old master is one with such influence among the governing class of this country, of which he has long been a member, that the average Englishman, if his name were mentioned, would think his power limitless. Yet that power he dare not exert to save his own son from a felon's life and death. However much he or another may suffer, publicity must be avoided, and this is a secret which cannot safely be shared with more than those who know it now. How many know it? In this country, 3 persons. In an American prison, 1. Have you kept up communication with the young man? Oh, yes. Direct? No, through a third person. My young master has implored his father not to write to him direct. This go-between, as we may call him, is the third person in the secret. Who is he? That I dare not tell you. Mr. Sanderson, it would be much better for your master and his son that you should be more open with me. These half-confidences are misleading. Has the son made any suggestion regarding his release? Oh, yes, but not the suggestion I have put before you. His latest letter was to the effect that within 6 months or so there is to be an election for governor. He proposes that a large sum of money shall be used to influence this election, so that a man pledged to pardon him may sit in the governor's chair. I see. And this sum of money is to be paid to the third person you referred to? Yes. May I take it that this third person is the one to whom various sums have been paid during the last 5 years, in order to bribe the governor to pardon the young man? Sanderson hesitated a moment before answering. In fact, he appeared so torn between inclination and duty, anxious to give me whatever information I deemed necessary, yet hemmed in by the instructions with which his master had limited him, that at last I waved my hand and said, "You need not reply, Mr. Sanderson. That third party is the crux of the situation. I strongly suspect him of blackmail. If you would but name him, and allow me to lure him to these rooms, I possess a little private prison of my own into which I could thrust him, and I venture to say that before he had passed a week in darkness on bread and water, we should have the truth about this business. Look you now the illogical nature of an Englishman. Poor old Sanderson, who had come to me with a proposal to break the law of America, seemed horror-stricken when I airily suggested the immuring of a man in a dungeon here in England. He gazed at me in amazement, then cast his eyes furtively about him, as if afraid a trap-door would drop beneath him and land him in my private oubliette. Do not be alarmed, Mr. Sanderson, you are perfectly safe. You are beginning at the wrong end of this business, and it seems to me 5 years of contributions to this third party without any result might have opened the eyes of even the most influential nobleman in England, not to mention those of his faithful servant. Indeed, sir, said Sanderson, I must confess to you that I have long had a suspicion of this third person, but my master has clung to him as his only hope, and if this third person were interfered with, I may tell you that he has deposited in London at some place unknown to us a full history of the case, and if it should happen that he disappears for more than a week at a time, this record will be brought to light. My dear Mr. Sanderson, that device is as old as Noah and his ark. I should chance that. Let me lay this fellow by the heels, and I will guarantee that no publicity follows. Sanderson sadly shook his head. Everything might happen as you say, sir, but all that would put us no further forward. The only point is the liberation of my young master. It is possible that the person unmentioned, whom we may call Number 3, has been cheating us throughout. But that is a matter of no consequence. Pardon me, but I think it is. Suppose your young master here and at liberty. This Number 3 would continue to maintain the power over him which he seems to have held over his father for the last 5 years. I think we can prevent that, sir, if my plan is carried out. The scheme for bribing the American officials is yours, then?
Yes, sir.
And I may say I am taking a great deal upon myself in coming to you. I am, in fact, disobeying the implied commands of my master. But I have seen him pay money, and very large sums of money, to this number three, for the last 5 years, and nothing has come of it. My master is an unsuspicious man, who has seen little of the real world, and thinks everyone as honest as himself.
Well, that may be, Mr. Sanderson, but permit me to suggest that the one who proposes a scheme of bribery, and, to put it mildly, an evasion of the law, shows some knowledge of the lower levels of this world, and is not quite in a position to plume himself on his own honesty.
I am coming to that, Mr. Valmont. My master knows nothing whatever of my plan. He has given me the huge sum of money demanded by number three, and he supposes that amount has been already paid over. As a matter of fact, it has not been paid over, and will not be until my suggestion has been carried out and failed. In fact, I am about to use this money, all of it if necessary, if you will undertake the commission. I have paid number three his usual monthly allowance, and will continue to do so. I have told him my master has his proposal under consideration, that there are still 6 months to come and go upon, and that my master is not one who decides in a hurry. Number three says there is an election in 6 months for governor. What is the name of the state?
Sanderson informed me.
I walked to my bookcase and took down a current American yearbook, consulted it, and returned to the table. There is no election in that state, Mr. Sanderson, for 18 months. Number three is simply a blackmailer, as I have suspected.
Quite so, sir, replied Sanderson, taking a newspaper from his pocket.
I read in this paper an account of a man immured in a Spanish dungeon. His friends arranged it with the officials in this way. The prisoner was certified to have died, and his body was turned over to his relatives. Now, if that could be done in America, it would serve two purposes. It would be the easiest way to get my young master out of the jail. It would remain a matter of record that he had died. Therefore, there could be no search for him, as would be the case if he simply escaped. If you were so good as to undertake this task, you might perhaps see my young master in his cell, and ask him to write to this number three with whom he is in constant communication, telling him he was very ill. Then you could arrange with the prison doctor that this person was informed of my young master's death.
Very well, we can try that. But a blackmailer is not so easily thrown off the scent. Once he has tasted blood, he is a human man-eating tiger. But still, there is always my private dungeon in the background, and if your plan for silencing him fails, I guarantee that my more drastic and equally illegal method will be a success. It will be seen that my scruples concerning the acceptance of this commission and my first dislike for the old man had both faded away during the conversation which I have set down in the preceding chapter. I saw him under the stress of deep emotion, and latterly began to realise the tremendous chances he was taking in contravening the will of his imperious master. If the large sum of money was long withheld from the blackmailer, Douglas Sanderson ran the risk of number three opening communication direct with his master. Investigation would show that the old servant had come perilously near laying himself open to a charge of breach of trust, and even of defalcation with regard to the money. And all this danger he was heroically incurring for the unselfish purpose of serving the interests of his employer. During our long interview, old Sanderson gradually became a hero in my eyes, and entirely in opposition to the resolution I had made at the beginning, I accepted his commission at the end of it. Nevertheless, my American experiences are those of which I am least proud, and all I care to say upon the subject is that my expedition proved completely successful. The late convict was my companion on the Arontic, the first steamship sailing for England after we reached New York from the West. Of course I knew that 2 or 3 years roughing it in mining camps and on ranches, followed by 5 years in prison, must have produced a radical effect not only on the character but also in the personal appearance of a man who had undergone these privations. Nevertheless, making due allowance for all this, I could not but fear that the ancient English family of which this young man was the hope and pride would be exceedingly disappointed with him. In spite of the change which grooming and the wearing of a civilized costume made, Wyoming Ed still looked much more the criminal than the gentleman. I considered myself in honour bound not to make any inquiries of the young man regarding his parentage. Of course, if I had wished to possess myself of the secret, I had but to touch a button under the table when Sanderson left my rooms in the Imperial Flats, which would have caused him to be shadowed and run to earth. I may also add that the ex-prisoner volunteered no particulars about himself or his family. Only once on board ship did he attempt to obtain some information from me, as we walked up and down the deck together. "You're acting for someone else, I suppose," he said. "Yes." "For someone in England?" "Yes." "He put up the money, did he?" "Yes." There was a pause, during which we took 2 or 3 turns in silence. "Of course there's no secret about it," he said at last. "I expected help from the other side, but Colonel Jim has been so mighty long about it I was afraid he'd forgotten me."
"Who is Colonel Jim?"
"Colonel Jim Baxter. Wasn't it him gave you the money?"
"I never heard of the man before."
"Then who put up the coin?"
"Douglas Sanderson," I replied, looking at him sideways as I mentioned the name. It had apparently no effect upon him. He wrinkled his brow for a moment and then said, "Well, if you never heard of Baxter, I never heard of Sanderson." This led me to suspect that Douglas Sanderson did not give me his own name, and doubtless the address with which he had furnished me was merely temporary. I did not cable to him from America regarding the success of the expedition, because I could not be certain it was a success until I was safely on English ground, and not even then, to tell the truth. Anyhow, I wished to leave no trail behind me. But the moment the Arontic reached Liverpool, I telegraphed Sanderson to meet us that evening at my flat. He was waiting for me when Wyoming Ed and I entered together. The old man was quite evidently in a state of nervous tension. He had been walking up and down the room with hands clenched behind his back, and now stood at the end farthest from the door, as he heard us approach, with his hands still clasped behind his back, and an expression of deep anxiety upon his rugged face. All the electric lamps were turned on, and the room was bright as day. "Have you not brought him with you?" he cried.
"Brought him with me?" I echoed. "Here is Wyoming Ed." The old man glared at him for a moment or two, stupefied, and then moaned, "Oh, my God, my God, that is not the man!" I turned to my short-haired fellow traveller. "You told me you were Wyoming Ed." He laughed uneasily. In a manner of speaking, so I have been for the last 5 years, but I wasn't Wyoming Ed before that. Say, old man, are you acting for Colonel Jim Baxter?" Sanderson, on whom a dozen years seemed to have fallen since we entered the room, appeared unable to speak, and merely shook his head in a hopeless sort of way. "I say, boys," ejaculated the ex-convict with an uneasy laugh, half comic, half bewildered, "this is a sort of mix-up, isn't it? I wish Colonel Jim was here to explain. I say, boss," he cried suddenly, turning sharp on me, "this here misfit's not my fault. I didn't change the children in the cradle. You don't intend to send me back to that hell-hole, do you?" "No," I said, "not if you tell the truth. Sit down." The late prisoner seated himself in a chair as close to the door as possible, hitching a little nearer as he sat down. His face had taken on a sharp, crafty aspect, like that of a trapped rat. "You're perfectly safe," I assured him. "Sit over here by the table. Even if you bolted through that door, you couldn't get out of this flat. Mr. Sanderson, take a chair." The old man sank despondently into the one nearest at hand. I pressed a button, and when my servant entered, I said to him, "Bring some cognac and Scotch whisky, glasses and 2 siphons of soda."
"You haven't got any Kentucky or Canadian?" asked the prisoner, moistening his lips.
The jail whiteness in his face was now accentuated by the pallor of fear, and the haunted look of the escaped convict glimmered in his eyes. In spite of the comfort I had attempted to bestow upon him, he knew that he had been rescued in mistake for another, and for the first time since he left prison realized he was among strangers, and not among friends. In his trouble he turned to the beverage of his native continent. "Bring a bottle of Canadian whisky," I said to the servant, who disappeared and shortly returned with what I had ordered. I locked the door after him and put the key in my pocket. "What am I to call you?" I asked the ex-convict. With a forced laugh, he said, "You can call me Jack, for short." "Very well, Jack, help yourself." And he poured out a very liberal glass of the Dominion liquor, refusing to dilute it with soda. Sanderson took Scotch, and I helped myself to a petit verre of brandy. "Now, Jack," I began, "I may tell you plainly that if I wished to send you back to prison, I could not do so without incriminating myself. You are legally dead, and you have now a chance to begin life anew, an opportunity of which I hope you will take advantage. If you were to apply 3 weeks from today at the prison doors, they would not dare admit you. You are dead. Does that console you?"
"Well, Squire, you can bet your bottom dollar I never thought I'd be pleased to hear I was dead, but I'm glad if it's all fixed as you say, and you can bet your last pair of boots I'm going to keep out of the jug in future if I can."
"That's right. Now I can promise that if you answer all my questions truthfully, you shall be given money enough to afford you a new beginning in life."
"Good enough," said Jack, briefly.
"You were known in prison as Wyoming Ed."
"Yes, sir."
"If that was not your name, why did you use it?"
"Because Colonel Jim on the train asked me to do that. He said it would give him a pull in England to get me free."
"Did you know Wyoming Ed?"
"Yes, sir. He was one of us three that held up the train."
"What became of him?"
"He was shot dead."
"By one of the passengers?"
There was silence, during which the old man groaned and bowed his head. Jack was studying the floor. Then he looked up at me and said, "You don't expect me to give a pal away, do you?"
"As that pal has given you away for the last 5 years, it seems to me you need not show very much consideration for him."
"I'm not so sure he did."
"I am, but never mind that point. Colonel Jim Baxter shot Wyoming Ed and killed him."
"Why?"
"See here, my friend, you're going a little too fast. I didn't say that." He reached somewhat defiantly for the bottle from Canada.
"Pardon me," I said, rising quietly and taking possession of the bottle myself. "It grieves me more than I can say to restrict my hospitality. I have never done such a thing in my life before, but this is not a drinking bout. It is a very serious conference. The whisky you have already taken has given you a bogus courage and a false view of things. Are you going to tell me the truth, or are you not?"
Jack pondered on this for a while, and then he said,
"Well, sir, I'm perfectly willing to tell you the truth as far as it concerns myself, but I don't want to rat on a friend."
"As I have said, he isn't your friend. He told you to take the name of Wyoming Ed so that he might blackmail the father of Wyoming Ed. He has done so for the last 5 years, living in luxury here in London and not moving a finger to help you. In fact, nothing would appall him more than to learn that you are now in this country. By this time he has probably received the news from the prison doctor that you are dead, and so thinks himself safe forever."
"If you can prove that to me," said Jack.
"I can and will," I interrupted. Then, turning to Sanderson, I demanded, "When are you to meet this man next?"
"Tonight at 9 o'clock," he answered. "His monthly payment is due, and he is clamouring for the large sum I told you of."
"Where do you meet him? In London?"
"Yes."
"At your master's town house?"
"Yes."
"Will you take us there, and places where we can see him and he can't see us?"
"Yes, I trust to your honour, Mr. Valmont,
A closed carriage will call for me at 8, and you can accompany me. Still, after all, Mr. Valmont, we have no assurance that he is the same person this young man refers to. I am certain he is. He does not go under the name of Colonel Jim Baxter, I suppose. No. The convict had been looking from one to the other of us during this colloquy. Suddenly he drew his chair up closer to the table. "Look here," he said. "You fellas are square, I can see that, and after all said and done, you're the man that got me out of clink. Now, I half suspicion you're right about Colonel Jim, but anyhow, I'll tell you exactly what happened. Colonel Jim was a Britisher, and I suppose that's why he and Wyoming Ed chummed together a good deal. We called Jim Baxter Colonel, but he never said he was a colonel or anything else. I was told he belonged to the British Army and that something happened in India so that he had to light out. He never talked about himself, but he was a mighty taking fellow when he laid out to please anybody. We called him Colonel because he was so straight in the back and walked as if he were on parade. When this young English tenderfoot came out, he and the Colonel got to be as thick as thieves, and the Colonel won a good deal of money from him at cards. But that didn't make any difference in their friendship. The Colonel almost always won when he played cards, and perhaps that's what started the talk about why he left the British Army. He was the luckiest beggar I ever knew in that line of business. We all met in the rush to the new goldfields, which didn't pan out worth a cent, and one after another of the fellas quit and went somewhere else. But Wyoming Ed, he held on, even after Colonel Jim wanted to quit. As long as there were plenty of fellas there, Colonel Jim never lacked money, although he didn't dig it out of the ground. But when the population thinned down to only a few of us, then we all struck hard times. Now, I knew Colonel Jim was going to hold up a train. He asked me if I'd join him, and I said I would if there wasn't too many in the gang. I'd been into that business afore, and I knew there was no greater danger than to have a whole mob of fellows. Three men can hold up a train better than three dozen. Everybody's scared except the express messenger, and it's generally easy to settle him, for he stands where the light is and we shoot from the dark. Well, I thought at first Wyoming Ed was on to the scheme, because when we were waiting in the cut to signal the train, he talked about us going on with her to San Francisco. For I thought he was only joking. I guess that Colonel Jim imagined that when it came to the pinch, Ed wouldn't back out and leave us in the lurch. He knew Ed was as brave as a lion. In the cut, where the train would be on the upgrade, the Colonel got his lantern ready, lit it and wrapped a thin red silk handkerchief round it. The express was timed to pass up there about midnight, but it was near 1 o'clock when a headlight came in sight. We knew all the passengers would be in bed, in the sleepers, and asleep in the smoking car and the day coach. We didn't intend to meddle with them. The Colonel had brought a stick or two of dynamite from the mines and was going to blow open the safe in the express car and climb out with whatever was inside. The train stopped to the signal all right, and the Colonel fired a couple of shots just to let the engineer know we meant business. The engineer and fireman at once threw up their hands, and then the Colonel turns to Ed, who was standing there like a man pole-axed, and says to him, mighty sharp, just like as if he was speaking to a regiment of soldiers, "You keep these two men covered. Come on, Jack," he says to me, and then we steps up to the door of the express car, which the fellow inside had got locked and bolted. The Colonel fires his revolver in through the lock, then flung his shoulder agin the door, and it went in with a crash, which was followed instantly by another crash, for the little expressman was game right through. He'd put out the lights and was blazing away at the open door. The Colonel sprang for cover inside the car and wasn't touched, but one of the shots took me just above the knee and broke my leg, so I went down in a heap. The minute the Colonel counted 7 shots, he was on to that express messenger like a tiger and had him tied up in a hard knot before he could shake a stick. Then, quick as a wink, he struck a match and lit the lamp. Plucky as the express messenger was, he looked scared to death. And now when Colonel Jim held a pistol to his head, he gave up the keys and told him how to open the safe. I had fallen back against the corner of the car inside and was groaning with pain. Colonel Jim was scooping out the money from the shelves of the safe and stuffing it into a sack. "Are you hurt, Jack?" he cried. "Yeah, my leg's broke. Don't let that trouble you. We'll get you clear all right. Do you think you can ride your horse?" "I don't believe it," I said. "I guess I'm done for." And I thought I was. Colonel Jim never looked round, but he went through that safe in a way that'd make your hair curl, throwing aside the bulky packages after tearing them open, taking only cash, which he thrust into a bag he had with him, till he was loaded like a millionaire. Then suddenly he swore, for the train began to move. "What's that fool Ed doing?" he shouted, rising to his feet. At that minute, Ed came in, pistol in each hand and his face ablaze. "Here, you cursed thief," he cried. "I didn't come with you to rob a train." "Get outside, you fool," roared Colonel Jim. "Get outside and stop this train. Jack's got his leg broke. Don't come another step toward me, or I'll kill you." But Ed, he walked right on, Colonel Jim backing. Then there was a shot that rang like cannon fire in the closed car, and Ed fell forward on his face. Colonel Jim turned him over, and I saw he'd been hit square in the middle of the forehead. The train was now going at good speed, and we were already miles away from where our horses were tied. I never heard a man swear like Colonel Jim. He went through the pockets of Ed and took a bundle of papers that was inside his coat, and this he stuffed away in his own clothes. Then he turned to me, and his voice was like a lamb. "Jack, old man," he said, "I can't help you. They're going to nab you, but not for murder. The expressman there will be your witness. It isn't murder anyhow on my part, but self-defense. You saw he was coming at me when I warned him to keep away." All this he said in a loud voice for the expressman to hear, and then he bent over to me and whispered, "I'll get the best lawyer I can for you, but I'm afraid they're bound to convict you, and if they do, I'll spend every penny of this money to get you free. You call yourself Wyoming Ed at the trial. I've taken all this man's papers so that he can't be identified. And don't you worry if you're sentenced, for remember, I'll be working night and day for you. And if money can get you out, you'll be got out, because these papers will help me to get the cash required. Ed's folks are rich in England, so they'll fork over to get you out if you pretend to be him." With that, he bade me goodbye and jumped off the train. There, gentlemen, that's the whole story, just as it happened, and that's why I thought it was Colonel Jim had sent you to get me free. There was not the slightest doubt in my mind that the convict had told the exact truth, and that night at 9 o'clock he identified Major Wren as the former Colonel Jim Baxter. Sanderson placed us in a gallery where we could see, but could not hear. The old man seemed determined that we should not know where we were, and took every precaution to keep us in the dark. I suppose he put us out of earshot, so that if the Major mentioned the name of the nobleman, we should not be any the wiser. We remained in the gallery for some time after the Major had left, before Sanderson came to us again, carrying with him a packet. "The carriage is waiting at the door," he said, "and with your permission, Monsieur Valmont, I will accompany you to your flat." I smiled at the old man's extreme caution, but he continued very gravely, "It's not that, Monsieur Valmont. I wish to consult with you, and if you will accept it, I have another commission to offer." "Well," said I, "I hope it's not so unsavoury as the last," but to this the old man made no response. There was silence in the carriage as we drove back to my flat. Sanderson had taken the precaution of pulling down the blinds of the carriage, which he need not have troubled to do, for, as I have said, it would have been the simplest matter in the world for me to have discovered who his employer was, if I had desired to know. As a matter of fact, I do not know to this day whom he represented. Once more in my room, with the electric light turned on, I was shocked and astonished to see the expression on Sanderson's face. It was the face of a man who would grimly commit murder and hang for it. If ever the thirst for vengeance was portrayed on a human countenance, it was on his that night. He spoke very quietly, laying down the packet before him on the table. "I think you will agree with me," he said, "that no punishment on earth is too severe for that creature calling himself Major Wren." "I'm willing to shoot him dead in the streets of London tomorrow," said the convict, "if you give the word." Sanderson went on implacably. "He not only murdered the son, but for 5 years has kept the father in an agony of sorrow and apprehension, bleeding him of money all the time, which was the least of his crimes. Tomorrow I shall tell my master that his son has been dead these 5 years, and heavy as that blow must prove, it will be mitigated by the fact that his son died an honest and honourable man. I thank you for offering to kill this vile criminal. I intend that he shall die, but not so quickly or so mercifully." Here he untied the packet, and took from it a photograph which he handed to the convict. "Do you recognise that?" "Oh, yes, that's Wyoming Ed, as he appeared at the mine, as indeed he appeared when he was shot." The photograph Sanderson then handed to me. "An article that I read about you in the paper, Monsieur Valmont, said you could impersonate anybody. Can you impersonate this young man?" "There's no difficulty in that," I replied. "Then will you do this? I wish you, too, to dress in that fashion. I shall give you particulars of the haunts of Major Wren. I want you to meet him together and separately as often as you can until you drive him mad or to suicide." "He believes you to be dead," said Sanderson, addressing Jack. "I am certain he has the news by his manner tonight. He is extremely anxious to get the lump sum of money which I have been holding back from him. You may address him, for he will recognise your voice as well as your person. But Monsieur Valmont had better not speak, as then he might know it was not the voice of my poor young master. I suggest that you meet him first together, always at night. The rest I leave in your hands, Monsieur Valmont." With that the old man rose and left us. Perhaps I should stop this narration here, for I have often wondered if practically I am guilty of manslaughter. We did not meet Major Wren together, but arranged that he should encounter Jack under one lamp-post and me under the next. It was just after midnight, and the streets were practically deserted. The theatre crowds had gone, and the traffic was represented by the last buses and a belated cab now and then. Major Wren came down the steps of his club, and under the first lamp-post, with the light shining full upon him, Jack the convict stepped forth. "Colonel Jim," he said, "Ed and I are waiting for you. There were three in that robbery, and one was a traitor. His dead comrades asked the traitor to join them." The major staggered back against the lamp-post, drew his hand across his brow and muttered, Jack told me afterwards, "I must stop drinking. I must stop drinking." Then he pulled himself together and walked rapidly toward the next lamp-post. I stood out square in front of him, but made no sound. He looked at me with distended eyes, while Jack shouted out in his boisterous voice, that had no doubt often echoed over the plain, "Come on, Wyoming Ed, and never mind him. He must follow." Then he gave a war whoop. The major did not turn round, but continued to stare at me, breathing stertorously like a person with apoplexy. I slowly pushed back my hat, and on my brow he saw the red mark of a bullet hole. He threw up his hands and fell with a crash to the pavement. Heart failure was the verdict of the coroner's jury. End of chapter 7. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Chetcris, London, UK. The Triumphs of Eugene Valmont by Robert Barr. Chapter 8. Lady Alicia's Emeralds. Many Englishmen, if you speak to them of me, indulge themselves in a detraction that I hope they will not mind my saying is rarely graced by the delicacy of innuendo with which some of my own countrymen attempt to diminish whatever merit I may possess. Mr. Spencer Hale, of Scotland Yard, whose lack of imagination I have so often endeavoured to amend, alas, without perceptible success, was good enough to say, after I had begun these reminiscences, which he read with affected scorn, that I was wise in setting down my successes, because the life of Methuselah himself would not be long enough to chronicle my failures. And the man to whom this was said replied that it was only my artfulness, a word of which these people are very fond, that I intended to use my successes as bait, issue a small pamphlet filled with them, and then record my failures in 1,000 volumes, after the plan of a Chinese encyclopedia, selling these to the public on the instalment plan. Ah, well, it is not for me to pass comment on such observations. Every profession is marred by its little jealousies, and why should the coterie of detection be exempt? I hope I may never follow an example so deleterious, and thus be tempted to express my contempt for the stupidity with which, as all persons know, the official detective system of England is imbued. I have had my failures, of course. Did I ever pretend to be otherwise than human? But what has been the cause of these failures? They have arisen through the conservatism of the English. When there is a mystery to be solved, the average Englishman almost invariably places it in the hands of the regular police. When these good people are utterly baffled, when their big boots have crushed out all evidences that the grounds may have had to offer to a discerning mind, when their clumsy hands have obliterated the clues which are everywhere around them, I am at last called in, and if I fail, they say, "What could you expect? He's a Frenchman." This was exactly what happened in the case of Lady Alicia's emeralds. For 2 months the regular police were not only befogged, but they blatantly sounded the alarm to every thief in Europe. All the pawnbrokers' shops of Great Britain were ransacked, as if a robber of so valuable a collection would be foolish enough to take it to a pawnbroker. Of course, the police say that they thought the thief would dismantle the cluster and sell the gems separately. As to this necklace of emeralds, possessing as it does an historical value, which is probably in excess of its intrinsic worth, what more natural than that the holder of it should open negotiations with its rightful owner, and thus make more money by quietly restoring it than by its dismemberment and sale piecemeal? But such a fuss was kicked up, such a furore created, that it is no wonder the receiver of the goods lay low and said nothing. In vain were all ports giving access to the continent watched. In vain were the police of France, Belgium, and Holland warned to look out for this treasure. 2 valuable months were lost, and then the Marquis of Blair sent for me. I maintain that the case was hopeless from the moment I took it up. It may be asked why the Marquis of Blair allowed the regular police to blunder along for 2 precious months, but anyone who is acquainted with that nobleman will not wonder that he clung so long to a forlorn hope. Very few members of the House of Peers are richer than Lord Blair, and still fewer more penurious. He maintained that, as he paid his taxes, he was entitled to protection from theft, that it was the duty of the government to restore the gems, and if this proved impossible, to make compensation for them. This theory is not acceptable in the English courts, and while Scotland Yard did all it could during those 2 months, what but failure was to be expected from its limited mental equipment? When I arrived at the Manor of Blair, as his lordship's very ugly and somewhat modern mansion house is termed, I was instantly admitted to his presence. I had been summoned from London by a letter in his lordship's own hand, on which the postage was not paid. It was late in the afternoon when I arrived, and our first conference was what might be termed futile. It was taken up entirely with haggling about terms, the Marquis endeavouring to beat down the price of my services to a sum so insignificant that it would barely have paid my expenses from London to Blair and back. Such bargaining is intensely distasteful to me. When the Marquis found all his offers declined with a politeness which left no opening for anger on his part, he endeavoured to induce me to take up the case on a commission contingent upon my recovery of the gems. And as I had declined this for the 20th time, darkness had come on, and the gong rang for dinner. I dined alone in the salle à manger, which appeared to be set apart for those calling at the mansion on business, and the meagreness of the fare, together with the indifferent nature of the claret, strengthen my determination to return to London as early as possible next morning. When the repast was finished, the dignified serving man said gravely to me, "The Lady Alicia asks if you will be good enough to give her a few moments in the drawing-room, sir." I followed the man to the drawing-room, and found the young lady seated at the piano, on which she was strumming idly and absent-mindedly, but with a touch nevertheless that indicated advanced excellence in the art of music. She was not dressed as one who had just risen from the dining-table, but was somewhat grimly and commonly attired, looking more like a cottager's daughter than a member of a great country family. Her head was small, and crowned with a mass of jet-black hair. My first impression on entering the large, rather dimly lighted room was unfavourable, but that vanished instantly under the charm of a manner so graceful and vivacious that in a moment I seemed to be standing in a brilliant Parisian salon rather than in the sombre drawing-room of an English country house. Every poise of her dainty head, every gesture of those small, perfect hands, every modulated tone of the voice, whether sparkling with laughter or caressing in confidential speech, reminded me of the grande dame of my own land. It was strange to find this perfect human flower amidst the gloomy ugliness of a huge square house built in the time of the Georges. But I remembered now that the Blairs are the English equivalent of the de Bellairs of France, from which family sprang the fascinating Marquise de Bellair, who adorned the court of Louis XIV. Here, advancing towards me, was the very reincarnation of the lovely Marquise, who gave lustre to this dull world nearly 300 years ago. Ah, after all, what are the English but a conquered race? I often forget this, and I trust I never remind them of it, but it enables one to forgive them much. A vivid 20th-century Marquise was Lady Alicia, in all except attire. What a dream some of our Parisian dress artists could have made of her. And here she was immured in this dull English house, in a high-necked costume of a labourer's wife. "Welcome, Monsieur Valmont," she cried in French of almost faultless intonation. "I am so glad you have arrived." And she greeted me as if I were an old friend of the family. There was nothing of condescension in her manner, no display of her own affability, while at the same time teaching me my place, and the difference in our stations in life. I can stand the rudeness of the nobility, but I detest their condescension. No, Lady Alicia was a true de Bellair, and in my confusion, bending over her slender hand, I said, "Madame la Marquise, it is a privilege to extend to you my most respectful salutations." She laughed at this quietly, with the melting laugh of the nightingale. "Monsieur, you mistake my title. Although my uncle is a marquis, I am but Lady Alicia." "Your pardon, my lady. For the moment I was back in that scintillating court which surrounded Louis le Grand." "How flatteringly you introduce yourself, monsieur. In the gallery upstairs there is a painting of the Marquise de Bellair, and when I show it to you tomorrow, you will then understand how charmingly you have pleased a vain woman by your reference to that beautiful lady. But I must not talk in this frivolous strain, monsieur. There is serious business to be considered, and I assure you I looked forward to your coming, monsieur, with the eagerness of Sister Anne in the Tower of Bluebeard." I fear my expression as I bowed to her must have betrayed my gratification at hearing these words, so confidentially uttered by lips so sweet, while the glance of her lovely eyes was even more eloquent than her words. Instantly I felt ashamed of my chaffering over terms with her uncle. Instantly I forgot my resolution to depart on the morrow. Instantly I resolved to be of what assistance I could to this dainty lady. Alas, the heart of Valmont is today as unprotected against the artillery of inspiring eyes as ever it was in his extreme youth. "This house," she continued vivaciously, "has been practically in a state of siege for 2 months. I could take none of my usual walks in the gardens, on the lawns, or through the park, without some clumsy policeman in uniform crashing his way through the bushes, or some detective in plain clothes accosting me and questioning me under the pretense that he was a stranger who had lost his way. the lack of all subtlety in our police is something deplorable. I am sure the real criminal might have passed through their hands a dozen times unmolested, while our poor innocent servants and the strangers within our gates were made to feel that the stern eye of the law was upon them night and day. The face of the young lady was an entrancing picture of animated indignation as she gave utterance to this truism, which her countrymen are so slow to appreciate. I experienced a glow of satisfaction. "Yes," she went on, "they sent down from London an army of stupid men, who have kept our household in a state of abject terror for 8 long weeks, and where are the emeralds?" As she suddenly asked this question in the most Parisian of accents, with a little outward spreading of the hand, a flash of the eye, and a toss of the head, the united effect was something indescribable, through the limitations of the language I'm compelled to use. "Well, monsieur, your arrival has put to flight this tiresome brigade, if indeed the word flight is not too airy a term to use towards a company so elephantine, and I assure you a sigh of relief has gone up from the whole household, with the exception of my uncle. I said to him at dinner tonight, if Monsieur Valmont had been induced to take an interest in the case at first, the jewels would have been in my possession long before tonight." "Ah, my lady," I protested, "I fear you overrate my poor ability. It is quite true that if I had been called in on the night of the robbery, my chances of success would have been infinitely greater than they are now." "Monsieur," she cried, clasping her hands over her knees and leaning towards me, hypnotizing me with those starry eyes, "Monsieur, I am perfectly confident that before a week is past, you will restore the necklace, if such restoration be possible. I have said so from the first. Now, am I right in my conjecture, monsieur, that you come here alone, that you bring with you no train of followers and assistants?" "That is as you have stated it, my lady." "I was sure of it. It is to be a contest of trained mentality, in opposition to our 2 months' experience of brute force. Never before had I felt such ambition to succeed, and a determination not to disappoint took full possession of me. Appreciation is a needed stimulant, and here it was offered to me in its most intoxicating form. Ah, Valmont, Valmont, will you never grow old? I am sure that at this moment, if I had been 80, the same thrill of enthusiasm would have tingled to my fingers' ends. Leave the manor of Blair in the morning? Not for the Bank of France." "Has my uncle acquainted you with particulars of the robbery?" "No, madame, we were talking of other things." The lady leaned back in her low chair, partially closed her eyes, and breathed a deep sigh. "I can well imagine the subject of your conversation," she said at last. "The Marquis of Blair was endeavouring to impose usurer's terms upon you, while you, nobly scorning such mercenary considerations, had perhaps resolved to leave us at the earliest opportunity. I assure you, my lady, that if any such conclusion had been arrived at on my part, it vanished the moment I was privileged to set foot in this drawing-room." "It is kind of you to say that, monsieur. But you must not allow your conversation with my uncle to prejudice you against him. He is an old man now, and of course has his fancies. You would think him mercenary, perhaps, and so he is. But then so, too, am I. Oh, yes, I am, monsieur, frightfully mercenary. To be mercenary, I believe, means to be fond of money. No one is fonder of money than I, except perhaps my uncle. But you see, monsieur, we occupy the two extremes. He is fond of money to hoard it. I am fond of money to spend it. I am fond of money for the things it will buy. I should like to scatter largesse as did my fair ancestress in France. I should love a manor-house in the country and a mansion in Mayfair. I could wish to make everyone around me happy if the expenditure of money would do it. That is a form of money, love, Lady Alicia, which will find a multitude of admirers." The girl shook her head and laughed merrily. "I should so dislike to forfeit your esteem, Monsieur Valmont, and therefore I shall not reveal the depth of my cupidity. You will learn that probably from my uncle, and then you will understand my extreme anxiety for the recovery of these jewels." "Are they very valuable?" Oh, yes. The necklace consists of 20 stones, no one of which weighs less than an ounce. Altogether, I believe they amount to 2,400 or 2,500 carats, and their intrinsic value is £20 a carat at least. So you see, that means nearly £50,000. Yet even this sum is trivial compared with what it involves. There is something like 1,000,000 at stake, together with my coveted manor house in the country and my equally coveted mansion in Mayfair. All this is within my grasp if I can but recover the emeralds. The girl blushed prettily as she noticed how intently I regarded her while she evolved this tantalizing mystery. I thought there was a trace of embarrassment in her laugh when she cried, "Oh, what will you think of me when you understand the situation? Pray, pray do not judge me harshly. I assure you the position I aim at will be used for the good of others as well as for my own pleasure. If my uncle does not make a confidant of you, I must take my courage in both hands and give you all the particulars, but not tonight. Of course, if one is to unravel such a snarl as that in which we find ourselves, he must be made aware of every particular, must he not?"
"Certainly, my lady."
"Very well, Monsieur Valmont. I shall supply any deficiencies that occur in my uncle's conversation with you. There is one point on which I should like to warn you. Both my uncle and the police have made up their minds that a certain young man is the culprit. The police found several clues which apparently led in his direction, but they were unable to find enough to justify his arrest. At first I could have sworn he had nothing whatever to do with the matter, but lately I am not so sure. All I ask of you, until we secure another opportunity of consulting together, is to preserve an open mind. Please do not allow my uncle to prejudice you against him."
"What is the name of this young man?"
"He is the Honourable John Haddon."
"The Honourable? Is he a person who could do so dishonourable an action?"
The young lady shook her head. "I am almost sure he would not, and yet one never can tell. I think at the present moment there are one or two noble lords in prison, but their crimes have not been mere vulgar housebreaking."
"Am I to infer, Lady Alicia, that you are in possession of certain facts unknown either to your uncle or the police?"
"Yes."
"Pardon me, but do these facts tend to incriminate the young man?" Again the young lady leaned back in her chair and gazed past me, a wrinkle of perplexity on her fair brow. Then she said very slowly, "You will understand, Monsieur Valmont, how loath I am to speak against one who was formerly a friend. If he had been content to remain a friend, I am sure this incident which has caused us all such worry and trouble would never have happened. I do not wish to dwell on what my uncle will tell you was a very unpleasant episode, but the Honourable John Haddon is a poor man, and it is quite out of the question for one brought up as I have been to marry into poverty. He was very headstrong and reckless about the matter, and involved my uncle in a bitter quarrel while discussing it, much to my chagrin and disappointment. It is as necessary for him to marry wealth as it is for me to make a good match, but he could not be brought to see that. Oh, he is not at all a sensible young man, and my former friendship for him has ceased. Yet I should dislike very much to take any action that might harm him. Therefore, I have spoken to no one but you about the evidence that is in my hands, and this you must treat as entirely confidential, giving no hint to my uncle, who is already bitter enough against Mr. Haddon." "Does this evidence convince you that he stole the necklace?"
"No, I do not believe that he actually stole it, but I am persuaded he was an accessory after the fact. Is that the legal term? Now, Monsieur Valmont, we will say no more tonight. If I talk any longer about this crisis, I shall not sleep, and I wish, assured of your help, to attack the situation with a very clear mind tomorrow." When I retired to my room, I found that I, too, could not sleep, although I needed a clear mind to face the problem of tomorrow. It is difficult for me to describe accurately the effect this interview had upon my mind, but to use a bodily simile, I may say that it seemed as if I had indulged too freely in a subtle champagne which appeared exceedingly excellent at first, but from which the exhilaration had now departed. No man could have been more completely under a spell than I was when Lady Alicia's eyes first told me more than her lips revealed. But although I had challenged her right to the title mercenary when she applied it to herself, I could not but confess that her nonchalant recital regarding the friend who desired to be a lover jarred upon me. I found my sympathy extending itself to that unknown young man, on whom it appeared the shadow of suspicion already rested. I was confident that if he had actually taken the emeralds, it was not at all from motives of cupidity. Indeed, that was practically shown by the fact that Scotland Yard found itself unable to trace the jewels, which at least they might have done if the necklace had been sold either as a whole or dismembered. Of course, an emerald weighing an ounce is by no means unusual. The Hope emerald, for example, weighs 6 ounces, and the gem owned by the Duke of Devonshire measures 2¼ inches through its greatest diameter. Nevertheless, such a constellation as the Blair emeralds was not to be disposed of very easily, and I surmised no attempt had been made either to sell them or to raise money upon them. Now that I had removed myself from the glamour of her presence, I began to suspect that the young lady, after all, although undoubtedly possessing the brilliancy of her jewels, retained also something of their hardness. There had been no expression of sympathy for the discarded friend. It was too evident, recalling what had latterly passed between us, that the young woman's sole desire, and a perfectly natural desire, was to recover her missing treasure. There was something behind all this which I could not comprehend, and I resolved in the morning to question the Marquis of Blair as shrewdly as he cared to allow. Failing him, I should cross-question the niece in a somewhat drier light than that which had enshrouded me during this interesting evening. I care not who knows it, but I have been befooled more than once by a woman. But I determined that in clear daylight I should resist the hypnotizing influence of those glorious eyes. Mon Dieu, mon Dieu, how easy it is for me to make good resolutions when I am far from temptation. It was 10 o'clock next morning when I was admitted to the study of the aged bachelor Marquis of Blair. His keen eyes looked through and through me as I seated myself before him. Well, he said shortly. My lord, I began deliberately, I know nothing more of the case than was furnished by the accounts I have read in the newspapers. 2 months have elapsed since the robbery. Every day that passed made the detection of the criminal more difficult. I do not wish to waste either my time or your money on a forlorn hope. If, therefore, you will be good enough to place me in possession of all the facts known to you, I shall tell you at once whether or not I can take up the case. "Do you wish me to give you the name of the criminal?" asked his lordship. "Is his name known to you?" I asked in return. "Yes, John Haddon stole the necklace." "Did you give that name to the police?" "Yes." "Why didn't they arrest him?" "Because the evidence against him is so small, and the improbability of his having committed the crime is so great." "What is the evidence against him?" His lordship spoke with the dry deliberation of an aged solicitor. "The robbery was committed on the night of October the 5th. All day there had been a heavy rain, and the grounds were wet. For reasons into which I do not care to enter, John Haddon was familiar with this house and with our grounds. He was well known to my servants, and, unfortunately, popular with them, for he is an open-handed spendthrift. The estate of his elder brother, Lord Steffenham, adjoins my own to the west, and Lord Steffenham's house is 3 miles from where we sit. On the night of the 5th, a ball was given in the mansion of Lord Steffenham, to which, of course, my niece and myself were invited, and which invitation was accepted. I had no quarrel with the elder brother. It was known to John Haddon that my niece intended to wear her necklace of emeralds. The robbery occurred at a time when most crimes of that nature are committed in country houses, namely while we were at dinner, an hour during which the servants are almost invariably in the lower part of the house. In October the days are getting short. The night was exceptionally dark, for although the rain had ceased, not a star was visible. The thief placed a ladder against the sill of one of the upper windows, opened it and came in. He must have been perfectly familiar with the house, for there are evidences that he went direct to the boudoir where the jewel case had been carelessly left on my niece's dressing table when she came down to dinner. It had been taken from the strong room about an hour before. The box was locked, but of course that made no difference. The thief wrenched the lid off, breaking the lock, stole the necklace and escaped by the way he came. Did he leave the window open and the ladder in place? Yes. Doesn't that strike you as very extraordinary? No. I do not assert that he's a professional burglar who would take all the precautions against the discovery that might have been expected from one of the craft. Indeed, the man's carelessness in going straight across the country to his brother's house and leaving footsteps in the soft earth, easily traceable almost to the very boundary fence, shows he's incapable of any serious thought. Is John Haddon rich? He hasn't a penny. Did you go to the ball that night? Yes, I had promised to go. Was John Haddon there? Yes, but he appeared late. He should have been present at the opening, and his brother was seriously annoyed by his absence. When he did come, he acted in a wild and reckless manner, which gave the guests the impression he'd been drinking. Both my niece and myself were disgusted with his actions. Do you think your niece suspects him? She certainly did not at first, and was indignant when I told her, coming home from the ball, that her jewels were undoubtedly in Steffenham House, even though they were not round her neck. But latterly I think her opinion has changed. To go back a moment, did any of your servants see him prowling about the place? They all say they didn't, but I myself saw him just before dusk, coming across the fields towards this house, and next morning we found the same footprints both going and coming. It seems to me the circumstantial evidence is rather strong. It's a pity that no one but yourself saw him. What more evidence are the authorities waiting for? They're waiting until he attempts to dispose of the jewels. You think, then, he has not done so up to date? I think he will never do so. Then why did he steal them? To prevent the marriage of my niece with Jonas Carter of Sheffield, to whom she is betrothed. They were to be married early in the new year. My lord, you amaze me. If Mr. Carter and Lady Alicia are engaged, why should the theft of the jewels interfere with the ceremony? Mr. Jonas Carter's a most estimable man who, however, does not move in our sphere of life. He's connected with the steel or cutlery industry and is a person of great wealth, rising upwards of a million, with a large estate in Derbyshire and a house fronting Hyde Park in London. He's a very strict businessman, and both my niece and myself agree that he's also an eligible man. I myself am rather strict in matters of business, and I must admit that Mr. Carter showed a very generous spirit in arranging the preliminaries of the engagement with me. When Alicia's father died, he had run through all the money he himself possessed or could borrow from his friends. Although a man of noble birth, I never liked him. He was married to my only sister. The Blair Emeralds, as perhaps you know, descend down the female line. They, therefore, came to my niece from her mother. My poor sister had long been disillusioned before death released her from the titled scamp she'd married, and she very wisely placed the emeralds in my custody to be held in trust for her daughter. They constitute my niece's only fortune, and would produce, if offered in London today, probably 75 or 100,000 pounds, although actually they're not worth so much. Mr. Jonas Carter very amiably consented to receive my niece with a dowry of only £50,000, and that money I offered to advance if I was allowed to retain the jewels as security. This was arranged between Mr. Carter and myself. But surely Mr. Carter does not refuse to carry out his engagement because the jewels has been stolen? He does. Why should he not? Then surely you will advance the 50,000 necessary? I will not. Why should I? Well, it seems to me, said I, with a slight laugh, the young man has very definitely checkmated both of you. He has, until I have laid him by the heels, which I'm determined to do if he were the brother of 20 Lord Steffenhams. Please answer one more question. Are you determined to put the young man in prison, or would you be content with the return of the emeralds intact?"
"Of course I should prefer to put him in prison and get the emeralds too, but if there's no choice in the matter, I must content myself with the necklace."
"Very well, my lord. I will undertake the case."
This conference had detained us in the study till after 11, and then, as it was a clear, crisp December morning, I went out through the gardens into the park, that I might walk along the well-kept private road and meditate upon my course of action, or rather think over what had been said, because I could not map my route until I had heard the secret which the Lady Alicia promised to impart. As at present instructed, it seemed to me the best way to go direct to the young man, show him as effectively as I could the danger in which he stood, and if possible persuade him to deliver up the necklace to me. As I strolled along under the grand old leafless trees, I suddenly heard my name called impulsively two or three times, and, turning round, saw the Lady Alicia running towards me. Her cheeks were bright with nature's rouge, and her eyes sparkled more dazzlingly than any emerald that ever tempted man to wickedness.
"Oh, Monsieur Valmont, I've been waiting for you, and you escaped me. Have you seen my uncle?"
"Yes, I've been with him since 10 o'clock.
"Well?"
"Your ladyship, that is exactly the word with which he accosted me."
"Ah, you see an additional likeness between my uncle and myself this morning, then."
"Has he told you about Mr. Carter?"
"Yes."
"So now you understand how important it is that I should regain possession of my property."
"Yes," I said with a sigh, "the house near Hyde Park and the great estate in Derbyshire." She clapped her hands with glee, eyes and feet dancing in unison as she capered along gaily beside me, a sort of skippity-hop, skippity-hop, sideways, keeping pace with my more stately step, as if she were a little girl of 6, instead of a young woman of 20.
"Not only that," she cried, "but £1,000,000 to spend. Oh, Monsieur Valmont, you know Paris, and yet you do not seem to comprehend what that plethora of money means."
"Well, madame, I have seen Paris, and I have seen a good deal of the world, but I am not so certain you will secure the million to spend."
"What?" she cried, stopping short, that little wrinkle which betokened temper appearing on her brow. "Do you think we won't get the emeralds, then?"
"Oh, I am sure we will get the emeralds. I, Valmont, pledge you my word. But if Mr. Jonas Carter, before marriage, calls a halt upon the ceremony until your uncle places £50,000 upon the table, I confess I am very pessimistic about your obtaining control of the million afterwards."
All her vivacity instantaneously returned. "Phew!" she cried, dancing round in front of me, and standing there directly in my path so that I came to a stand. "Phew!" she repeated, snapping her fingers, with an inimitable gesture of that lovely hand. "Monsieur Valmont, I am disappointed in you. You are not nearly so nice as you were last evening. It is very uncomplimentary in you to intimate that when once I am married to Mr. Jonas, I shall not wheedle from him all the money I want. Do not rest your eyes on the ground. Look at me and answer."
I glanced up at her and could not forbear laughing. The witchery of the wood was in that girl. Yes, and a perceptible trace of the Gallic devil flickered in those enchanting eyes of hers. I could not help myself.
"Ah, Madame la Marquise de Belair, how jauntily you would scatter despair in that susceptible court of Louis."
"Ah, Monsieur Eugène de Valmont," she cried, mimicking my tones, and imitating my manner with an exactitude that amazed me. "You are once more my dear de Valmont of last night. I dreamed of you, I assure you I did, and now to find you in the morning, oh, so changed!" She clasped her little hands and inclined her head, while the sweet voice sank into a cadence of melancholy, which seemed so genuine that the mocking ripple of a laugh immediately following was almost a shock to me. Where had this creature of the dull English countryside learnt all such frou-frou of gesture and tone? "Have you ever seen Sarah Bernhardt?" I asked. Now the average Englishwoman would have inquired the genesis of so inconsequent a question, but Lady Alicia followed the trend of my thought and answered at once as if my query had been quite expected. Mais non, monsieur. Sarah the Divine. Ah, she comes with my million a year and the house of Hyde Park. No, the only inhabitant of my real world whom I have yet seen is Monsieur Valmont, and he, alas, I find so changeable. But now, adieu frivolity, we must be serious. And she walked sedately by my side. Do you know where you are going, monsieur? You are going to church. Oh, do not look frightened, not to a service. I am decorating the church with holly, and you shall help me and get thorns in your poor fingers. The private road, which up to this time had passed through a forest, now reached a secluded glade, in which stood a very small but exquisite church, evidently centuries older than the mansion we had left. Beyond it were grey stone ruins, which Lady Alicia pointed out to me as remnants of the original mansion that had been built in the reign of the second Henry. The church, it was thought, formed the private chapel to the hall, and it had been kept in repair by the various lords of the manor. Now hearken to the power of the poor, and learn how they may flout the proud Marquis, cried Lady Alicia gleefully. The poorest man in England may walk along this private road on Sunday to the church, and the proud Marquis is powerless to prevent him. Of course, if the poor man prolongs his walk, then he is in danger from the law of trespass. On weekdays, however, this is the most secluded spot on the estate, and I regret to say that my lordly uncle does not trouble it even on Sundays. I fear we are a degenerate race, Monsieur Valmont, for doubtless a fighting and deeply religious ancestor of mine built this church, and to think that when the useful masons cemented these stones together, Madame le Marquise de Bel-Air or Lady Alicia were alike unthought of. And though 300 years divide them, this ancient chapel makes them seem, as one might say, contemporaries. Oh, Monsieur Valmont, what is the use of worrying about emeralds or anything else? As I look at this beautiful old church, even the house of Hyde Park appears as naught. And to my amazement, the eyes that Lady Alicia turned upon me were wet. The front door was unlocked. We walked into the church in silence. Around the pillars, holly and ivy were twined. Great armfuls of the shrubs had been flung here and there along the walls in heaps, and a stepladder stood in one of the aisles, showing that the decoration of the edifice was not yet complete. A subdued melancholy had settled down on my erstwhile vivacious companion, the inevitable reaction so characteristic of the artistic temperament, augmented doubtless by the solemnity of the place, around whose walls in brass and marble were sculptured memorials of her ancient race. "You promised," I said at last, "to tell me how you came to suspect—" "Not here, not here," she whispered. Then rising from the pew in which she had seated herself, she said, "Let us go. I am in no mood for working this morning. I shall finish the decoration in the afternoon." We came out into the cool and brilliant sunlight again, and as we turned homeward, her spirits immediately began to rise. "I am anxious to know," I persisted, "why you came to suspect a man whom at first you believed innocent." "I am not sure but I believe him innocent now, although I am forced to the conclusion that he knows where the treasure is." "What forces you to that conclusion, my lady?" "A letter I received from himself, in which he makes a proposal so extraordinary that I am almost disinclined to accede to it, even though it leads to the discovery of my necklace. However, I am determined to leave no means untried, if I receive the support of my friend, Monsieur Valmont." "My lady," said I with a bow, "it is but yours to command, mine to obey." "What were the contents of that letter?" "Read it," she replied, taking the folded sheet from her pocket and handing it to me. She had been quite right in characterising the note as an extraordinary epistle. The Honourable John Haddon had the temerity to propose that she should go through a form of marriage with him in the old church we had just left. If she did that, he said, it would console him for the mad love he felt for her. The ceremony would have no binding force upon her whatever, and she might bring whom she pleased to perform it. If she knew no one that she could trust, he would invite an old college chum, and bring him to the church next morning at 7:30. Even if an ordained clergyman performed the ceremony, it would not be legal unless it took place between the hours of 8 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon. If she consented to this, the emeralds were hers once more. "This is the proposal of a madman," said I, as I handed back the letter. "Well," she replied, with a nonchalant shrug of her shoulders, "he has always said he was madly in love with me, and I quite believe it." Poor young man! If this mummery were to console him for the rest of his life, why should I not indulge him in it? Lady Alicia, surely you would not countenance the profaning of that lovely old edifice with a mock ceremonial? No man in his senses could suggest such a thing. Once more her eyes were twinkling with merriment. But the Honourable John Haddon, as I have told you, is not in his senses. Then why should you indulge him? Why? How can you ask such a question? Because of the emeralds. It is only a mad lark, after all, and no one need know of it. Oh, Monsieur Valmont, she cried pleadingly, clasping her hands, yet it seemed to me with an undercurrent of laughter in her beseeching tones, will you not enact for us the part of clergyman? I am sure if your face were as serious as it is at this moment, the robes of a priest would become you. Lady Alicia, you are incorrigible. I am somewhat a man of the world, yet I should not dare to counterfeit the sacred office, and I hope you but jest. In fact, I am sure you do, my lady. She turned away from me with a very pretty pout. Monsieur Valmont, your knighthood is, after all, but surface deep. 'Tis not mine to command and yours to obey. Certainly I did but jest. John shall bring his own imitation clergyman with him. Are you going to meet him tomorrow? Certainly I am. I have promised I must secure my necklace. You seem to place great confidence in the belief that he will produce it. If he fails to do so, then I play Monsieur Valmont as my trump card. But, Monsieur, although you quite rightly refuse to comply with my first request, you will surely not reject my second. Please meet me tomorrow at the head of the avenue promptly at 7:15, and escort me to the church. For a moment the negative trembled on my tongue's end, but she turned those enchanting eyes upon me, and I was undone. Very well, I answered. She seized both my hands like a little girl overjoyed at a promised excursion. Oh, Monsieur Valmont, you are a darling! I feel as if I'd known you all my life. I am sure you will never regret having humoured me. Then added a moment later, if we get the emeralds. Ah, said I, if we get the emeralds. We were now within sight of the house, and she pointed out our rendezvous for the following day, and with that I bade her good-bye. It was shortly after 7 o'clock next morning when I reached the meeting-place. The Lady Alicia was somewhat long in coming, but when she arrived her face was aglow with girlish delight at the solemn prank she was about to play. "You have not changed your mind?" I asked, after the morning's greetings. "Oh, no, Monsieur Valmont," she replied with a bright laugh. "I'm determined to recover those emeralds." "We must hurry, Lady Alicia, or we will be too late." "There's plenty of time," she remarked calmly, and she proved to be right, because when we came in sight of the church, the clock pointed to the hour of 7:30. "Now," she said, "I shall wait here until you steal up to the church and look in through one of the windows that do not contain stained glass. I should not for the world arrive before Mr. Haddon and his friend are there." I did as requested, and saw two young men standing together in the centre aisle, one in the full robes of a clergyman, the other in his ordinary dress, whom I took to be the Honourable John Haddon. His profile was toward me, and I must admit there was very little of the madman in his calm countenance. His was a well-cut face, clean-shaven and strikingly manly. In one of the pews was seated a woman. I learned afterwards she was Lady Alicia's maid, who had been instructed to come and go from the house by a footpath, while we had taken the longer road. I returned and escorted Lady Alicia to the church, and there was introduced to Mr. Haddon and his friend, the made-up divine. The ceremony was at once performed, and, man of the world as I professed myself to be, this enacting of private theatricals in a church grated upon me. When the maid and I were asked to sign the book as witnesses, I said, "Surely this is carrying realism a little too far." Mr. Haddon smiled and replied, "I am amazed to hear a Frenchman objecting to realism going to its full length, and speaking for myself, I should be delighted to see the autograph of the renowned Eugene Valmont." And with that he proffered me the pen, whereupon I scrawled my signature. The maid had already signed and disappeared. The reputed clergyman bowed us out of the church, standing in the porch to see us walk up the avenue. "Ed," cried John Haddon, "I'll be back within half an hour and will attend to the clock. You won't mind waiting?" "Not in the least, dear boy. God bless you both." And the tremor in his voice seemed to me carrying realism one step further still. The Lady Alicia, with downcast head, hurried us on until we were within the gloom of the forest, and then, ignoring me, she turned suddenly to the young man and placed her two hands on his shoulders. "Oh, Jack, Jack," she cried. He kissed her twice on the lips. "Jack, Monsieur Valmont insists on the emeralds." The young man laughed. Her ladyship stood fronting him with her back towards me. Tenderly the young man unfastened something at the throat of that high-necked dress of hers. Then there was a snap, and he drew out an amazing, dazzling, shimmering sheen of green that seemed to turn the whole bleak December landscape verdant, as with a touch of spring. The girl hid her rosy face against him, and over her shoulder, with a smile, he handed me the celebrated Blair emeralds. "There is the treasure, Valmont," he cried, "on condition that you do not molest the culprit." "Or the accessory after the fact," gurgled Lady Alicia in smothered tones, with a hand clasping together her high-necked dress at the throat. "We trust to your invention, Valmont, to deliver that necklace to Uncle, with a detective story that will thrill him to his very heart." We heard the clock strike eight. Then a second later, smaller bells chimed a quarter past, and another second after they tinkled the half-hour. "Hello!" cried Haddon. "Ed has attended to the clock himself. What a good fellow he is!" I looked at my watch. It was 9:25. "Was the ceremony genuine, then?" I asked. "Ah, Valmont," said the young man, patting his wife affectionately on the shoulder, "nothing on earth can be more genuine than that ceremony was." And the volatile Lady Alicia snuggled closer to him. End of chapter 8.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.